Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual. And, Jim, I'm not sure I would qualify the first one as a good martini, but I guess it's good that people who thought Obamacare was the greatest thing on earth are coming back to earth as they see how this is actually going to affect them. And we're talking about congressional staffers. This is from Politico. Veteran House Democratic aides are sick over the insurance prices they'll pay under Obamacare, and they're scrambling to find a cure. Under the Affordable Care Act and federal regulations, many congressional staffers designated as official aides were forced to move out of the old, heavily subsidized federal employees' health benefits program and onto the District of Columbia's health insurance marketplace exchange. Others were designated as unofficial, were allowed to stay in the federal program. Managers had to choose whether aides were official or unofficial by October 31st, and the sources say that wasn't enough time to make an informed decision about who would benefit and who would lose out by going into the new system. Age is one of the few factors insurers can use to adjust prices under Obamacare, and older people will often pay much more than younger people. Jim, I guess we're finding out who's essential and non-essential. We're also finding out, especially among the Democratic ranks, that if you like your plan, you can't keep it.
The staffer, Min Ta, who's chief of staff to Gwen Moore, a Democrat of Wisconsin, sends out this email saying, you know, simply unacceptable, shock to the, you know, making very clear. Then Politico calls up and they say, look, employees are not dissatisfied with the Affordable Care Act. No, it's really good, you know. And it says some younger staffers have seen their premiums fall. Well, here's the thing. The entire sales pitch for Obamacare was that it was all upside, no downside. You can't expand benefits for everybody and not have the money come from somewhere. And so now we're figuring out who the winners and losers are. And, you know, even members of Congress and their staffs, who you think would be the most, you know, likely to have read the 5,000-page bill and thought through how it was going to affect things, didn't realize that and kind of naively believed that everything would be hunky-dory. And now, of course, you know, it's interesting that they're going to the House Administration Committee. Can we redesignate someone? And so they're finding out, well, actually, no, you can't, at least not until next year. Next year, you'll be able to redesignate everyone and stuff like that. But even members of Congress don't really understand how this thing works, which I think says a great deal about the law. Every bit of cynicism the public has about members of Congress and how their staffs work and their lack of due diligence and their kind of blithe faith in their own ability to solve problems has been proven true through this. And, you know, it'd be very interesting to see what the mood in that office is as those older staffers are finding, you know, costs three, four times what they, you know, were paying before. Because the younger staffers might be, you know, hey, old geezer, how's it, you know, isn't this great? Isn't this awesome? You know, and you know, so the tension within the ranks should be rather fun for us to enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't want to see anyone struggling to get coverage, but the fact that these are the very people who told us we had to pass the bill to find out what was in it. These are the people that arrogantly told us that this was going to be exactly as Jim explained, roses and sunshine for everyone. And the fact now that they've got to pay the piper along with millions of Americans who never wanted anything like this in the first place, there is some delicious irony there, I have to say.
I'm having my irony with hollandaise sauce. You can enjoy it how you like, but no, delicious is exactly the word. And it's one of those things where up in Boston, you mentioned the quote of mankind will learn at the altar of experience and at no other. It may take something like this to get Democratic staffers to realize, oh, you know, these criticisms coming from the right were, you know, not us being terrible, hateful, mean, you know, cruel people. It's because, no, actually, we really had a sense that at some point, the money had to come from somewhere. Somebody was going to pay more, and somebody was going to end up feeling like they were getting gypped by this whole process. Well, here we are.
Speaking of getting gypped by the process, let's move to the second martini. It was yesterday's crazy, and that was Harry Reid's decision that yesterday was the day to go forward with the nuclear option, making it so that Republicans can no longer filibuster judicial and executive branch appointments. You now just need a simple majority to invoke cloture, which means if you got a simple majority, you're going to get what you want on nominations. Folks like Tom Harkin want to just do away with the filibuster altogether. The fun part of this, of course, has been going back to 2005 and looking at the statements by Harry Reid, then Senator Obama, and others about just how what a deplorable idea it was that Senate Republicans then were simply threatening to invoke the nuclear option, which they never actually did as a result of the Gang of 14. But you would have thought that the Constitution itself was being stuffed through the shredder. And the best quotes from 2005, though, which I would love to share, and I think folks have heard some of these, come from now Vice President Joe Biden. The first clip is of him explaining that if and when Bill Frist, the majority leader at that time, were to bring this to the floor, the Democratic leader would object on a point of inquiry and whether the move to change the rules on a majority vote was in parliamentary order. And here's how he would explain that the showdown would go with the vice president in the chair and the parliamentarian.
Hold your breath, parliamentarian. He's not going to look to you because he knows what you would say. He would say this is not parliamentarily appropriate. You cannot change the Senate rules by a pure majority vote.
Apparently you can.
Greg. Yes, we can.
and here's, of course, the one that more people have seen from yesterday, with him explaining how he hopes this will play out in the future.
The nuclear option abandons America's sense of fair play. It's the one thing this country stands for, not tilting the playing field on the side of those who control and own the field. I say to my friends on the Republican side, you may own the field right now, but you won't own it forever. And I pray God, when the Democrats take back control, we don't make the kind of naked power grab you are doing. But I'm afraid you will teach my new colleagues the wrong lesson.
Jim, I mean, there's hypocrisy all over the place in Washington, but anybody who misses it on this issue is blind and deaf.
Yeah, that's a really solid one there. You know, it's entirely possible we were destined to head down this road. That, you know, you have a situation in which the state of the country is that it's very unlikely that either party will have more than 60 seats anytime soon. Democrats came close in the first couple of years of Obama's presidency. But that's a lot, right? And we're a roughly evenly divided country, particularly, you know, in terms of the Senate. You're never going to see more than, you know, 5 or 6 is considered a big, you know, shifting year, and it's been around 50-50 for a long while. So you've got that aspect. So you're always going to have the minority is always going to want to have maximize their power and always going to want to use the filibuster, if not on everything, then basically on anything that is important enough to them that they feel like, okay, we really got to stop this. Let's filibuster this thing. The majority is always going to say, look, we have public opinion on our side. We have more than 50 votes, and, you know, I've always said with Obama's agenda, if you can't convince Olympia Snow or Susan Collins to vote for it, it's probably a bad idea, right? I mean, these are not fire-breathing, unreasonable right-wing maniacs. They are, you know, they're the nice lady caucus up in Maine. And Obama generally failed in that category. I guess they voted for the stimulus in the beginning, but couldn't pass it on Obamacare. There still exist moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans, and yet the proposals that are put forward were never quite good enough to get, you know, that anybody on the other side to buy into it. So we have this circumstance in which we have two very ideologically divided parties that want to take the country in diametrically opposite directions, in a circumstance in which neither one was going to have 60 votes. The side that had a little more than 40 votes was going to be able to stop things. I think the Democrats are nutty is this belief that, well, we're only doing it for circuit court judges. We're only going to do it for certain judges. We won't do it for a Supreme Court justice, and we won't do it for pieces of legislation. Greg, how long do you think it's going to remain that way?
Until there's a Supreme Court nomination.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, until there's something that the administration really, really wants, having now proven that we can blow up the filibuster when we really want something, when Obama nominates someone to the Supreme Court, unless he nominates somebody that, you know, Republicans like, and the odds of that are pretty darn unlikely, you'll end up with a scenario in which they'll say, you know what, we're putting Bill Ayers on the Supreme Court, you know, or Jeremiah Wright, or, you know, somebody who is the Republicans' worst nightmare. And Republicans will attempt a filibuster, and then the Democrats will say, look, you know, we really want this person on the Supreme Court, so we'll do it. And they'll blow that up. Now, the only good news for us is that January 2017, it's, you know, quite conceivable that we'll have a Republican president, a Republican Senate, and a Republican House. And some people might think that's wildly optimistic. But look, you know, Obamacare is looking like a mess. Democrat prospects in the Senate in 2014 midterms are looking pretty bad. And it's very tough to hold the presidency for more than 8 years. You add all that up, the chances of a Republican being in the position that Democrats are in, you know, not too long ago could occur. And now with this precedent, it's only going to take 51 Republican votes to do anything they want. Because once you've nuked it for one type of judge, you can nuke it for Supreme Court justices, and you sure as heck can nuke it for really important policy items. There's a reason they called it the nuclear option. You know, once you take that genie out of the bottle, it doesn't go back in. The next majority is never going to say, okay, we'll voluntarily take on these restrictions on our power and our ability to pass our agenda. And so, you know, you had a good run, filibuster. I hope you liked it. But look, and, you know, in years to come, we're going to see a lot more 51-49 votes ramming through controversial pieces of legislation, because that's now the way you get things done in this country.
Obama's statement yesterday about the basically being annoyed at the division of government, you know, that he can't just basically do whatever he wants by fiat, which he's doing anyway when it comes to delays and other changes to the healthcare law and many other things. So clearly somebody's not happy with the constitutional separation of powers. But fortunately, there are a bunch of guys back in the 18th century who thought it was a good idea. On to the crazy martini now, Jim. And of course, sequestration is still in effect. If you haven't been reminded of that lately, you can remember that was the president's idea, and so was specifically the cuts in the military. And so Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, according to Stars and Stripes, has tasked his comptroller and the joint staff to figure out a way to cut 28% out of commissary costs. And basically what the Defense Commissary Agency has come up with is a plan to close all stateside-based grocery stores. And, Jim, this is just horrific. I mean, our military folks are sacrificing so much already, not only putting their lives in danger and being apart from their family members. They're not getting paid much at all. Now they can't even get a good deal on groceries, and they can't even do it on base if this goes through.
Really tough to believe that this is the easiest. It actually may be the easiest place to cut. It's kind of hard to believe that, you know, this is the best idea for cutting either the federal budget or even the Pentagon budget. For those not familiar with commissaries, you know, they're basically supermarket and other type stores that are on military bases. A slight taxpayer subsidy. I remember there was one over in Turkey available to the U.S. forces that were working with, you know, the Turkish military over there. They are subsidized prices, but they're not, you know, it's not like the stuff is free. I mean, you know, this is just getting you a good price. And look, if you're on a military base, chances are, you know, in a lot of these communities, you're fairly isolated. You're fairly not in an environment where you may not necessarily have a ShopRite or Food Town or Harris Teeter or someplace right down the road. It just kind of seems like, really, military families are the ones who got to take the brunt for this? You know, it just seems like such a bizarre, otherworldly sense of priorities to not be able to find any pork in the Pentagon budget, any type of overcontracting, anything else that could, you know, that isn't priority to ask, you know, military families to take the hit on this. Remember when Chuck Hagel was going to be, you know, because he had served in combat, he would understand the military better than all those previous secretaries of defense, Greg?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah, that really panned out well.
Jim, it's good to have you back. We'll talk to you on Monday.
All right, see you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join us Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.